Welcome to Hollywood Ungagged, the Skunk and Ansie of political podcasts. Just recorded another episode, season three, episode three. We were supposed to record it 2 days ago, but I had some technical trouble on my computer and we had to delay it by 48 hours. Would have only been 24, but you know, Deborah had a concert to go to, so she talks a wee bit about that actually. Spoke a wee bit about Partygate as it rumbles on for, I don't know, what is this, 5 months? Boris Johnson still clinging on to power with everything he's got, like a limpet. We then spoke about the kind of debate about smacking children that's gone on at the moment in England, because it's recently been banned in Wales, it was banned in Scotland in 2020. Spoke a wee bit about that. And then we went on to talk about the misogyny that's kind of reared its head in the Houses of Parliament down in Westminster. Initially, and we were going to talk about the Angela Rayner story in the Mail on Sunday, but obviously new things have come out about kind of indirectly related the sort of misogynistic attitude that kind of seems to permeate Westminster with the fact that Tory MPs think it's acceptable to just sit and watch some porn on their phone in the debating chamber of all places. And then at the end, we have a wee talk about the elections next week and the voting system and a wee bit of back and forth about whether it's you should vote to evoke or whether you should just rank all candidates. So that's about it then. Hope you enjoy it and let's get ungagged. And it was nice to hear you smile. Dream a dream, cause you'll never die. The stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice to hear you smile. Hello and welcome to Holyrood Ungagged. It is season three. Episode three, and I am your host, David McClement, transmitting from the Blantyre Free State, and I'm joined by my two ever-present friends and comrades, Brian Stewart-Finlay
Hey,
and
hey.
Deborah Torrens. Welcome,
Yay.
guys. How are yous?
I'm good. How you doing?
Not bad. Well, just for all the listeners, we're just reminiscing about bars in Glasgow that are no longer there, Sadie Frost's and Eurobar, and Brian was trying to remember where it is now until we pointed out that the building is now gone. So we're all officially quite old.
Yeah, I remembered that. Well, realized that the whole building is now gone. Yeah, that's right. And that means the Burger King's away as well, surely.
I'm a bit disappointed. I did like that Burger King.
Yes.
I love a Burger King.
It's the
It's
best. I
the
mean,
best veggie options, absolutely,
it is
110%.
way above McDonald's for me.
Good start.
Good start. Where are we going with this?
Oh, season three, we've been pure fishing for sponsors. Last week it was Cadbury. This week it's
Cadbury's
we
and
just
Burger King, you
open
know.
up with we love Burger King.
Come give us money.
Aim kind of small. Go for the realistic targets of multinational Cadbury and Burger King. Fun fact, when I was a wee boy and I went to Australia to visit family when I was 10, I was absolutely astounded by the fact that Burger King is not called Burger King in Australia.
What's it
What's it
called?
called?
Hungry Jack's.
As mind-blowing. That's
imagine being 10 years old and finding that out.
has it got the same branding and stuff, but just the
Everything about it is the same, except it's called Hungry Jack's. The same logos and all that.
that's cute. That's just blown my mind.
I learned a cool fact today.
Go on.
Peanuts are not in fact nuts. They're the root system of a plant. And having wee shells. You go.
Look at that.
In
Come here.
fairness, you didn't say it was a fun fact. You just know.
Just to get us away from the trademark names.
And in fairness, nuts are not your department, so. Anyway, let's move on and get started with the business of the day, because these crap jokes is not going to keep anybody's attention.
He didn't even ask me how I was doing. He just
Well, I
asked
can't wait
I
that he
don't
just
care.
kept smiling at us. I asked you both at the same time. Brian took the lead, and then I kept looking at you, waiting for you to respond, and you just kept smiling at me. It was like, Deborah doesn't know what to say, how she is. Deborah finds that an invasive question. Deborah, how are you?
I'm fine.
Gold.
How was your
Glad
concert?
we waited for that one.
How was your concert? Tell us about your concert.
I went to see Skunk and Nancy. It Ooh. Was amazing. There was a couple of preview acts. One of them was very anti-Tory, which was nice. The second one was also very anti-Tory, which was nice. Got in a few fuck the Tory chants, which in an audience in Glasgow is great. I went to shout out Jen and the Degenerates, an LGBTQ band that was supporting Skunk and Nancy. I mean, she doesn't need a shout out their podcast. She's doing a world tour with Skin, which is amazing. But she was shouting about the conversion therapy ban, so was Skin as well. They were talking about that. Skin was also talking about the refugees and asylum seekers and just how Brexit has fucked her as an artist. And, you know, a small one doesn't have a big label at that. They sort of manage everything themselves. So it was one of the most political gigs I've ever been to, and also the first gig since lockdown. That's been waiting 2 years to go to that. So it was, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And if you were there, hello, I seen you in your denim jacket and your plaid shirt. Because everybody was wearing, I was also wearing very reminiscent of the 90s sort of style. And I had on black jeans with pure dazzling white trainers.
I thought you were sending a coded message to someone.
No, no,
I know.
That was
hello,
just,
you.
Everybody was wearing the same stuff because it was reliving the 90s, like the late 90s. It was wonderful.
See, for a second there, what I thought, you were at the Skunk and Nancy gig and somebody came running up and saying, oh my God, are you Deborah Torrance for the Hollywood and Done Gig podcast? But no, no, I think that was unlikely.
Highly.
So Partygate, is this the final act? Are we finally seeing the beginning of the end of the Boris Johnson regime? There's rumours about that the full Sue Gray report will be absolutely damning and leave him no choice but to resign. He's also going to be investigated by the Parliamentary Privilege Committee to confirm whether he broke the ministerial code. Under the ministerial code, anyone in government found to have knowingly misled MPs is, quotes, expected to resign. And government whips were scrambling Wednesday night trying to derail a Labour motion designed to trigger that inquiry, but they were unsuccessful. And the inquiry could also potentially release hundreds of damaging messages and photographs related to the parties. So, Deborah, what do you think? Are we finally seeing the beginning of the end?
Are we nearly there yet? Like, this just seems to have been dragging on for so long. Like, how much more damning evidence do we actually need? We already know a lot of stuff that has, you know, supposedly he was unaware of the bloody law he wrote. I can't believe this is still, I can't believe that this hasn't already ended him. Like, and I keep thinking about Allegra Stratton, like that, you know, first glimpse into, you know, that sort of mock press release when it all came out. I mean, we should have known when she resigned how big a deal it really was going to be, but I just never expected how long it would go on and 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 narrowed on. I don't really have any other words.
It is very strange that Allegra Stratton had to resign about joking about a potential partying down the street. But apparently all the people that actually were at an actual party don't so far. That seems a bit contradictory to me.
Do we have a total number of how many MPs, Tory MPs, have been charged?
No.
No.
It did say that they wouldn't be identifying people, which is why when Boris Johnson came out and said that he'd been done, it kind of raised eyebrows that he said, oh, I and Rishi Sunak as well. So it looked as if he was like, if I'm going down, I'm taking you away, mate. So I don't know. I presume, hopefully, you would think with this inquiry, something would come out about other MPs or members of the cabinet that have been involved. But so far, I don't think there's anything confirmed.
I think at the moment, we can safely say that 10 Downing Street is the place of which the most fixed penalty notices have been handed out to with a single address since the start of the COVID pandemic, you know, in the region of 50 and climbing, which is much higher than any other address in the UK. And this is the address of the man who was in charge of writing those laws for England. So that in itself is particularly damning. You know, we've spoken about this Partygate thing. Honestly, I don't remember when this actually started, because it just
I think it was October when the first sort of rumblings came out.
Mm-hmm. So this has been going on for a long time. Do I think it will be the end of Boris Johnson? Yes, but it won't happen for a long time. So this is basically just like being drawn out and drawn out and drawn out. And what if you watched Boris Johnson and PMQs today, you know, trying to ram it support from his Tories, and they're all cheering and yelping, and you know, as if they're a kind of unified party, which the Tories are generally quite good at pretending that they are a cohesive unit. But actually, when Boris Johnson, you know, as more things unfold, so more fixed penalty notices will be issued, the Prime Minister no doubt will have more of these to pay, and he should, and we hope he does come out and be clear about how many fixed penalty notices he's actually had. The Sugay report, which is apparently explosive, and I mean, I don't know what paper actually reported that, but I think it was the Times or the Telegraph or something of that ilk. To me, that's a bit concerning that it's coming from that particular paper, and I think, what are they trying to distract us from more than anything else? But as more and more information comes out, more and more backbenchers basically just lose faith in Boris Johnson. But the only reason they'll lose faith in him is if they bomb the local elections in England, which I think potentially might happen. Mm-hmm. And I live to see it. It would be great. Only bad thing about that is it's going to make Keir Starmer look good. And then it'll all be how great I am, and you know, how much revolutionary my party is, and how good that's going to be, when we know that's not the case. But when Boris Johnson becomes even more of a liability than what he currently is as leader for the Poland, for the Conservative Party, and for the political establishment to remain in power as it is, that's when he'll go. It won't be, you know, for all these horrendous things and, you know, all these people who have, you know, abided by the rules and didn't get to say goodbye to all their loved ones and being separated from people they love for so long. These things are terrible. And I've said this, I think, every time we talk about this, that this Prime Minister and this government shouldn't be going because Boris Johnson thought he was above the rules. They should be going because of the inequality and because of the unnecessary deaths because of COVID, the excessive deaths that we've experienced during the pandemic, exacerbating inequalities through work and through the welfare state and all of these different things. That's why this
government... All the corruption.
Forget the corruption. If you want to go back to season one, we had a great little jingle that went with that. So all of these things, that's why this government and why Boris Johnson should be going. And they should be replaced with someone who's actually going to give a shit, really. But unfortunately, it's not going to be for those reasons. And it will be because of Partygate, but it will be on the say-so of the backbenchers of the Tory party. And that will only happen when he is exposed as a political sort of pariah that's going to make the Tories lose power.
Yeah, I do wonder if the, like you say, because it was a sort of right-wing newspaper that was reporting the stuff about the Sue Gray report, if they're maybe trying to artificially inflate expectations. So maybe the report's bad, but can sort of inversely, if you convince everybody before they see it, it's going to be like horrifically bad. Their first reaction might be, not as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the thing about the ministerial code, you know, I highlighted, like, in quote, the expected to resign thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't say that you'll be fired or you will have to resign. It's just there's an expectation that you would, which I don't think anything that is relying on Boris Johnson being honourable is really get much hope of being successful.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, he'll just say, he'll just not do it. He'll just dig his heels in. And this whole British system of convention and deference and this is how we do things is just going to be shown to be completely impotent in the face of a stubborn proto-fascist that doesn't really care about how people did things before.
I think it was quite telling when Jacob Rees-Mogg defended the Prime Minister with a great analogy, totally relevant to the everyday man.
Mm-hmm.
LBW, which I had to look up, not going to lie, it's a cricket reference. And just basically that all the Partygate stuff is just, you know, it's the umpire seen it one way and the player seen it the other. And that's what it is to these people, a total game. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so frustrating, because you were mentioning Brian, like, he'll get to a stage where he's a complete pariah. How is he not already? And it's because media. He's backed up with the media and these bozos, like, bozos? Am I in 1950s?
You bozo.
No, these idiots like Jacob Rees-Mogg. I prefer Bozo. I'm sticking with that. Big Bozo.
Bozo Johnson.
Yeah, there was... I was trying to... I did read a tweet and I tried to look into it to see... And I couldn't... I didn't have much success, but the tweet that I read from an MP said that this inquiry could potentially lead to a recall petition in his constituency.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And to me, that was the first time that I felt like, well, that's something that actually might, as much as it would be a long process and a long shot, because it's not as if he's in a fairly safe constituency, but that would be something that it would be removed by power without mm-hmm. without us being reliant on him actually, like, you know, doing the honourable thing and throwing his cell and his sword. But that could be a really drawn out process. And before you know it, the Tory MP, he'll be turning around to the Tory MPs and saying, well, can he rock the boat now? There's an election coming up, and then they'll fall into line then. And before you know it, we're heading into another general election, and he'll get re-elected because the media will line up and assassinate, you know, the Labour leader, despite how much he thinks it'll not happen. Just to clarify, I'm talking about character assassination, not any other extreme forms. As much as I don't have much time for Keir Starmer, I'm not advocating anything like that. So... I think you're right as well, Brian. I think the local elections will have a big bearing. So hopefully we're sitting here next week in our election special, happily crowing about how much the Tories get a hammering, and that sets off alarm bells among MPs that decide to move against them. But we shall wait and see.
I really hope when we're having that election special, which I'll be excited about, looking at all these different seats and all these new councillors that have been elected and the shifts of power across the councils. I don't know if everyone shares my enthusiasm about this, but
I'm hoping
that we're reporting massive losses to the Scottish Conservatives. I think that, without going too much into that side of things, that the fact that they had such an amazing election in 2017, and I say amazing based on how horrendous it was before. I'm not saying it was like Ruth Davidson being this PR guru who, you know, basically essentially went out and hoodwinked the entire election to make it about send a message to Nicola Sturgeon about independence. What, from South Lanarkshire Council? I mean, is that something that we're going to do? Is Falkirk Council going to pass a motion to tell Nicola Sturgeon that we shouldn't have another NDREF too? I don't know. But yeah, that's basically what happened. The only way is down for the Scottish Conservatives, and this is only going to be amplified by the absolute tomfoolery that is going on in Westminster at the moment.
Okay, let's move on to the next topic. There is a debate raging in England about smacking children. So discussions about whether it's okay to assault children has arisen in England at the moment, because Wales has now outlawed the practice last month, following on from Scotland that did it in 2020. The current evidence against smacking is fairly unequivocal. A recent meta-analysis of more than 160,000 children found that hitting them as a form of discipline is ineffective at positively changing behaviour. That's both in the short and the long term. It also found that children who were disciplined with physical punishment were more likely to become aggressive, display antisocial behaviour and exhibit mental health problems as they grew up. The Education Secretary, Nadeem Zahawi, he said last week that he doesn't want to ban smacking in England, because it could end up in a world where the state is nannying people about how they bring up their children. And he said that he lightly smacks his 9-year-old daughter when her behaviour justifies it. The Labour view was that, from Wes Streeting, was that as a child who was smacked by their parents, he didn't think it did him any harm. And he also recognised that times have changed. Brian, thoughts?
I mean, I can't believe that we actually have to have this discussion about people who are in government and in the shadow cabinet are almost sort of downplaying the seriousness of it. I think that if you are in favour of physical violence towards children, I think that would really, I mean, that in itself, that's exactly what it is. And it's basically, you know, the smacking ban that was brought in Scotland, which was, again, fiercely debated. I remember the debates back in the day when politics wasn't a complete and utter carnage at that point. These debates were happening before the pandemic and things like that. in Scotland. And it's basically just about affording children the same protections and rights that adults have. So, you know, if I decided to go and smack someone in the street, you know, another adult, then I would, you know, I could rightly be punished for doing that. But are we saying that if I was to do that to a child in my care, that would not, that's somehow less? It's somehow something that because I am responsible for that child is okay? I mean, I just don't understand the argument to even start saying, yeah, well, it didn't do me any harm. But looking at your politics, mate, I don't know. I just think that to have that attitude about it didn't do me any harm is just, first of all, extremely individualistic, and you don't know the experiences of people, more vulnerable children, people who may have, maybe neurodiverse or might have behavioural problems or might, you know, act in certain ways in certain situations that have been traumatic for them, and that's seen as, you know, not behaving or not complying with the expectations that adults put on that child, so therefore we're going to give them more abuse and violence. I just don't understand where we even start with, oh, but maybe I can see where you're coming from when it comes to this, because first of all, I wouldn't hurt anybody, I wouldn't physically harm somebody. I certainly, if I did think it was acceptable to physically harm somebody for some bizarre reason, I certainly wouldn't think that it was sort of lesser or okay to do that to a child. I just think it's just, you know, I just can't start to see, yeah, where there is any understanding of where this policy is not a good thing. And this nanny and state thing, for goodness sake, it's just ridiculous, right? What nanny state is, you know, don't put your seatbelt on. Okay, well, you want to, you know, drive this machine at 70 miles an hour and not wear a seatbelt because, you know, the state's telling me to do it. Well, no, actually, what we're doing is we're trying not to kill you. We're trying not to harm you. And we're trying not to you to harm other people, whether they're in the car with you or, you know, involved in an accident or anything like that. It's just, this nanny state thing is absolute nonsense. Well, the thing is, this policy would be so difficult to enforce, right? So that you've got a smacking ban, you've got a child, there, you know, there's allegations of physical abuse towards a child, and trying to enforce this policy would be extremely difficult in a criminal stance, right? But what this policy is doing is the state is saying it is unacceptable for you to physically assault a child, right? In the same way that the state, you know, suggests that something is not a good thing to do. And it's basically the state enforcing those rules to try and reduce harm. That's what it's there for. And this nanny state nonsense is just ridiculous.
I mean, in some ways, I think a smacking ban is easier to enforce than the current situation. You know, it's very much more, you know, black and white. Mm-hmm. Did that person hit that child? Yes or no? Yes. Okay, then you broke the law. Whereas at the moment, it's like, did you hit that child? Yes. Well, how hard did you hit them? Mm-hmm. Well, kind of hard, but not too hard. And it's like, well, how does anybody know what's, you know, where do you draw that line? And everybody would draw that line in a different place. So in terms of clarity, I think one of the worst things about the law before the smacking ban came in was the real grey area around it. Deborah?
I just think that it's ridiculous. Why would you want to harm a wee human? Like, mm-hmm. they're so vulnerable and reliant on you as an adult. Like, I'm not a mother, but I'm an auntie and a great auntie. There's 26 swains in our family. And never, not once, would hitting any of them solve any of the situations. I mean, can negotiate with them, but don't go to violence. I know people that would go to prison because a stranger hit their dog. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I know people who would break the law and create violence because somebody hit a dog. I can't imagine what they would do if they witnessed somebody hitting a wain. I don't understand why certain politicians think corporal punishment for children, because that's what it is, mm-hmm. is it not? Mm-hmm. Hitting away is corporal punishment, is acceptable for children. And then I think, what type of school did they go to? Were they still belting wains in the school? It's archaic Tory mindset, in my opinion. But then when you hear about Wes Streeton and some of the sort of Labour viewpoints as well, it's like, why is this, as you say, Brian, why are we even talking about this? Don't hit wains, don't hit animals, don't hit old people, don't hit vulnerable, don't hit anybody.
Just don't have
like don't need violence. Use your words.
Just going to say, Deborah, you're saying you just kind of get your head around that, why somebody would hit a kid. As somebody with four kids, I can definitely understand the feeling of wanting to hit them at times. But any time that I've never hit my kids, and any time that feeling comes up when they are absolutely driving me around the bend, it would never be to correct their behaviour or show them right from wrong. That impulse is just coming from a place of mm-hmm. absolute irrational anger mm-hmm. and frustration. Hitting them would be about letting me feel better. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be about helping them at all. So when I hear like the education secretary coming out with stuff about hitting his daughter to justify her behaviour or whatever, just think that's you're kidding yourself on there, mate. You're losing your temper. Mm-hmm. And when you lose your temper and you hit somebody when it's allowed, I think it's quite frightening, because I think it's much more easier to then go too far
mm-hmm.
and then just maybe hit somebody a wee bit harder than you meant to. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
I think it's a slippery slope allowing it.
And children are such gentle wee souls as well, that like, I know some wains are wild, but like as sponges and, you know, absorbing learned behaviours mm-hmm. like you were mentioning earlier on, David, there's no proof that violence in any way helps shape a young mind. Like, we're better than we were back in the 70s. We don't need to keep regressing. Can we please go forward for a wee change?
Absolutely. I mean, how can I tell one of my kids not to hit their sister or their wee brother mm-hmm. if I was slapping them about mm-hmm. every time they annoyed me? You know, it's you're right. They soak up everything, and you know, they'll learn their angry lesson. They'll not learn the lesson that
exactly
people think.
Yeah, definitely.
But West Street, and like that whole kind of labour response, it's you could have wrote it down before you saw it. It's the case mm-hmm. of we don't quite agree, but don't stick our neck out too far, or we'll be labelled as being in favour of the nanny state or whatever.
Like West Street is possibly, I mean, there's so many things that I could say about West Street that I'm not going to say, but there West Street,
fire away.
West Street is like, you know, whether it's any really important human rights issue, because obviously this is human rights. You know, boil it all down, you know, with control and behaviour and discipline and all these. It's basically about human rights of protecting children from being physically abused. Right, that's exactly what we're talking about here, and it's the same thing as well, where West Street tries to mount and, you know, mount both sides to some extent, but actually miss the whole thing. You know, he's just completely missing the point. So he's basically trying to say, well, it never done me any harm, but, you know, times have changed. So it's like, you know, tick the right side, tick the left side. That's it. I've done a great job today. When actually you're not preaching to any choir, if that's what your intention was. And it's the same thing when we talk about really important human rights issues such as trans people, where he's very much like, you know, some people think this and some people think that, and you know, I think we should just be more understanding and we can have an open debate around it. Human rights issues are not human rights issues. Yeah, exactly. Human rights issues are not up for debate. Human rights protections are not up for debate. Okay, if you want to talk about how we protect them or how we reinforce them or how we educate people about protections of the human rights, that's, I'm all up for debating that and the best way to get the messages across. But when it comes to protections of human rights, it's not up for debate. It's about what the best way is to implement the policy to protect the vulnerable group and educate society so that they don't want to or try to, you know, impeach on somebody else's human rights.
It's one of the big things about centrism. It's mm-hmm. as the Overton window moves, mm-hmm. they move with it.
Yeah.
So they allow it to move so far to the right that they'll still be in the middle going, well, maybe we don't need to gas all of them. You know, it's... Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, they will absolutely sell out anybody if it becomes the sensible, moderate position.
And we've seen that with the discussion around sending asylum seekers to Rwanda, that yep. it's like, we're going to condemn it, but we're going to focus on how much it costs. You know, yep. it's almost like, well, we couldn't do that because, you know, Australia tried to do it and it was too expensive and we'll just be throwing more tax monies away. Well, no, we're not doing it because it's, you know, again, human rights. That should be the basis of all of these discussions. We're not going to send asylum seekers trying to get to the UK to Rwanda to be processed to potentially stay in Rwanda. That's not what we should be doing, because it's inhumane. Not because, oh, well, we think it's wrong because it might be unethical, but also look how much it costs. Centrism, like you say, with the Overton window, is just as problematic as those on the right mm-hmm. and on the far right.
It's just regressive policies, like mm-hmm. regressive policy after regressive policy. Mm-hmm. Well, let's smack the wains again. It's just, come on, enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
I know, we're regressing so much that Jacob Rees-Mogg will start to feel like he's, you know, not out of date. Okay, I think we've spoken enough about that. Let's, before we move on to our next subject, a word from our sponsor.
Our sponsor this week is Sense of Nature Pet Service, based in central Scotland. Sense of Nature gives you a hands-on, personalised experience with a variety of exciting creatures, from snakes and skunks to tarantulas and turtles. Sense of Nature has something for everyone. He offers sensory sessions, one-to-one and group sessions, educational encounters for children of all ages, and they are available for private events upon inquiry. Animal welfare is at the forefront of everything they do, and if appropriate, a risk assessment can be carried out at no additional cost prior to your booking. To get 5% off your next booking with Sense of Nature, quote Holyrood Ungagged 5 at time of booking. To contact Sense of Nature, you can do so by email on sense.of.natureinquiries@outlook.com. You can also find them on most social media platforms by searching for Sense of Nature.
So, misogyny in Westminster. This week there's been a couple of incidents. We were originally recording this in a couple of days ago, but technical issues meant we had to delay it. And we were going to talk about the stuff with Angela Rayner, where she was accused of putting off Boris Johnson by uncrossing her legs in the chambers at the House of Commons. Since that time, it's now come out that at least two Tory MPs have been caught sitting watching pornography in the debate chamber and in committee meetings. It's really quite astounding. It's hard to know what to say. Deborah, you want to kick off?
I don't really want to talk about the members of parliament sitting on their mobile devices accessing pornography. So I'm just going to go with the Rayner thing, if that's all right. While I was researching on this and reading all the perverted stuff, by the way, what is wrong with some journalists' heads? Or the MP who gave the quote, what are they thinking? That Angela Rayner's sitting there in a skirt just for the Prime Minister. Very good. But the basic instinct thing, do you know Sharon Stone wasn't aware of that scene?
Mm-hmm.
I told you that, Brian, that's how you
did. I know.
filmed. I have heard that, but it was like years and years after it before she came out with it.
Yeah, but as you were saying, that hyper misogynistic, sexualized sort of environment, I just thought it was interesting that I was reading about Hollywood back in Sharon Stone's heyday, and I was like, oh, look at all these parallels with what's happening in our House of Parliament. Like, is it not weird? I'll let you boys talk about the pornography, if that's all right, because I'm
you would think you could think we could have a higher expectation than an early 90s film, Hollywood film set for people's behaviour, but seemingly not when it comes to the Tories.
Homophobic as well, basic instinct, by the way, and making the lesbian the baddie. Just FYI.
This is taking a funny turn that I didn't think we're going to be discussing somewhat.
Let's bring
back Ungagged Film Club, and Deborah wants to talk about Basic Instinct. Brian, thoughts?
Aye, so I can certainly talk about the two MPs who've been accused of basically watching pornography in the Commons and in the committee, right? And just to, like, I mean, when I saw that headline flash up today, well, you know, I was looking at my phone just to see what's been happening in the news, and I was like, what's going on? Like, I honestly feel like we're completely through the looking glass when it comes to, you know, just even following what's happening in Westminster politics. But just to put this in context, if you were at work and you access something like that in your workplace, in a meeting around other people, you would likely be instantly suspended pending investigation, right? That's where we would start in that sort of situation. But there's corroboration with these as well. So, you know, there's a female MP, there's other people have come forward. And again, it just seems to be in Westminster with things like this, when it, you know, going back to the misogyny and sexism and the sexualization of anything really, that it's almost like it's just happening, and until, you know, you poke the bear, it stays under the surface. And that in itself is just emblematic of a really toxic workplace, right? When there's accusations like this that almost like, yeah, we always knew that, or, you know, there's always this problematic person who might work in the workplace and these accusations are made, and then everyone turns around and says, oh, we're not surprised. And it's that's emblematic of a really toxic workplace. If we've just heard about two MPs that have, you know, people have corroborated these allegations and things like that, then these people should not be MPs, first of all. You know, we need to do an investigation. You know, they need to be suspended, removed as a first point of contact, really. But then, you know, some people talk about Westminster and the Houses of Parliament as being like a normal workplace. It never, ever functions like a normal workplace. You know, it's the place of work where you could basically lie, but if you're accusing somebody of lying, you could be removed. Absolutely just crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Some of the discourse that came after the Angela Rayner stuff as well, mm-hmm. was all focused around how the stuff I heard on the radio anyway was about women's attire and how, mm-hmm. you know, they shouldn't really be wearing skirts anyway. And see all that sort of attitude, it wasn't of any surprise to me. So although you're saying that it's under the surface, mm-hmm. I think for women in politics, it's very much mm-hmm. at breaking the surface on many mm-hmm. occasions. The whole, I don't know, is it, do some guys get into politics because they think it's sexy? Like, I don't understand in what frame of mind somebody must be. He'd be sitting in a big debating chamber in the House of Commons, surrounded by wood and leather. You know, it's very much like a courtroom. It's very official, lots of pomp and ceremony. And he whips out his Pornhub on his iPhone. I don't, why? Can either of you explain that to me?
I can't.
No. It's the short answer. It's absolutely baffling. When I first heard it, my immediate reaction was like, well, this is obviously an outlier. This is like, clearly, who knows, some of the people that are getting elected, and this is some absolute lunatic that's got a safe seat in Toryland somewhere. Then it came out again that there was two, and you're thinking, right, okay, well, this is actually a bigger issue, and what does that say about the culture of, you know, the people in House of Commons, that, you know, somebody doesn't turn up on their first day and sit watching porn. You know, this is somebody doing that because other things have happened that have pushed the mm-hmm. boundaries to the point where they think that that's something that's acceptable in any way.
What, like where people think it's acceptable to break social norms, lie, and not follow the rules?
Maybe. What is interesting as well, I thought, is in the age of hyper-partisan politics between parties, this is the first time, and I don't know how long, where there seemed to be genuine solidarity from like Tory MPs towards Angela Rayner and things like that. And it seems as if there is a kind of mini Me Too movement breaking out amongst female Conservative MPs. That's at the, I think, a meeting of the 2022 committee. They basically, I think they all just started putting forward all their experiences. But where does that go? You know, who's going to deal with that? Because it's clearly not a normal workplace where you could just refer someone to HR and they would hopefully deal with it. You know, this is a workplace where people can turn up drunk and it's... you're not even allowed to say that. You know, if somebody's drunk in the House of Commons, or you can, and they ask a question, all the responder can do is say, oh, they're obviously tired and emotional, which is code for the member is steaming drunk and doesn't know what they're talking about.
That's just crazy, isn't it? And just echoing what you were saying there about like the experiences of female MPs, and which we're now starting to see through these women in the Conservative Party coming forward, that when I was saying about these things coming to the surface, it seems to be in the media, and it seems to be that the media chooses when these types of stories come out and how they're framed. And this takes us very much back to the heart of the Angela Rayner thing. So, you know, this story was broke in the Mail on Sunday, right?
Yeah. With a full article.
with this lobby journalist who has, you know, taken this quote from an anonymous MP, which is extremely misogynist, extremely just, actually not just misogynist, but delusional, right? That this, mm-hmm. that they yes. actually think that this is, you know, what Angela Rayner was trying to achieve out of this. Like, you know, some, the whole thing is just frankly really bizarre, right? As well as extremely misogynistic.
It's very classist as well.
Of course, yeah. Always getting there. About the state educated Angela Rayner, who, you know, and you know, I'll come back to this very briefly, but, you know, Angela Rayner, who is somebody who can command an audience and is very clear and concise in what it is that she wants to try and put forward. And it's, yeah, the classist aspect of it too, saying that, you know, well, Boris Johnson's a much better debater than Angela Rayner. Well, I'm sorry, but I don't know what debates they've been watching, because that's certainly not the case. So yeah, there is certainly the class element to it as well. But it's more the fact that the Mail on Sunday decided to run the story from that angle, that, you know, this is what Angela Rayner's been up to, look, you know, doing all these things and Basic Instinct and blah, 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 when actually the story should have been this Tory MP actually thought Angela Rayner was doing this, and it's really misogynistic, and perhaps we should be looking into the behaviour of, you know, Tory MPs or MPs right across the House on their attitude towards women MPs. That really should have been the story that came from that. And, you know, but of course it's the Mail on Sunday, who is the sister paper of the Daily Mail. The Daily Mail, who has been trumpeting the gender critical movement, you know, mm-hmm. So what, apparently amplifying the voices to protect women, yet actually running stories about like this. So
of course,
the Daily Mail, I think, in a story of the day, saying that Angela Rayner loves getting sexist abuse.
Oh, well, yeah, because she was laughing about it, wasn't she? Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure Angela Rayner did not find any of this funny. And I'm pretty sure that if Angela Rayner was laughing at it, it was out of complete, just the delusion that that person must have experienced to think that that's what she was trying to achieve. I think that's the only thing that she would have found funny. I don't think she found the attention that she would have got. I don't think that for so many times when Angela Rayner is trying to make really good and valid points about the Tories and to use some of the quotes that she used, the colourful language that she likes to use sometimes towards the Conservatives, that, you know, they automatically go in with, oh, well, she's not educated, she's, you know, not articulate, she's not this. And what you're doing is basically trying to belittle what Angela Rayner's saying without actually challenging what she said. You're saying it's how she said it and how it was delivered, and, you know, and her background as an individual, which quite frankly is just reinforcing all the things that Angela Rayner says, and the fact that it just exposes again the media, the MPs, the political class right across the whole of the UK are so detached from the realities of working class people. Yeah. And the reason it maintains like that is because they can constantly perpetuate this absolute nonsense that working class people can't be articulate, can't be passionate, and can't be leaders. And it has to stop. And the only way it's going to stop is if working class people organise against it.
Yeah, I think it also highlights an actual perversion in our political class, like from the deluded thoughts of, oh, this woman sitting across from me is trying to seduce me with her skirt, or, you know, the MPs watching pornography while at their work. I just think that, and there's a lot of projection from the Tory party when it comes to the lower classes, so to speak, that they're filthy and fornicate, and that, you know, we're always drunk and inebriated and don't know how to spend our money. I think that that whole Victorian Edwardian idealism is very much the driving force in Westminster. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's really them that's sick and perverted and wasting all the money, and corrupt and liars.
The liars.
I did wonder if a lot of this, if this story was kind of planted. Because we've heard before about the Tories, I can't remember who it was, one of the Tory advisors that talked about the dead cat story. He's saying no matter what's happening, what's discussed, if there's some stuff getting discussed in the media, like Partygate, that you don't want to deal with, you throw a dead cat on the table and nobody will talk about anything else except the fact there's a dead cat on the table. And the way this story came out, and then how sort of theatrical way Boris Johnson like summoned the editor for a dressing down, how strongly he came out against it. I mean, when has Boris ever been on the right side of anything like that?
Mm.
You know, the quote, I think he said that he would unleash the terrors of the earth on the MP if they were identified.
Why don't you just employees?
And also, like, the way he was like tweeting solidarity right away, even though it was like copied and pasted exactly what Nadine Dorries had, did as well, like word for word, which makes you think it's just been done with some Tory intern that's running the social media for them. So it did Good make lads. Me wonder, is did he throw this out to try and distract and make himself look like the hero? Or was he just upset that he looked kind of pathetic? You know, that somebody, like one of his own MPs apparently thought he was getting distracted by the fact that Angela Rayner was wearing the skirt, you know. There was just something about it very strange. Like, it's not often you see Boris on the right side, so am I being paranoid?
No, I think it's an interesting perspective. Because I wouldn't put it past them. I thought Rwanda was a sort of diversionary story. Is the Rwanda refugee situation was a diversionary story as well. So when they put anything past them.
It would be so, I mean, they're so incompetent. It would be so like them that they plant this story to try and distract and completely it erupts into a total misogyny, getting it revealed or through the Tory party.
The ideal.
And I think what you're saying, like, you know, the dead cat story is sometimes we don't know what's the dead cat and what's the really deadly policy. So, you know, where a lot of these policies lead to inequality and death for some people, and particularly the most vulnerable in our society. And it's so true that the way it sort of came out, and, you know, it's like some sort of imaginary Tory MP potentially has said these things to some bad person in the Daily Mail, and the Daily Mail's gone and, you know, created this story. It's not out with the realms of possibility, but, you know, if this Tory MP has briefed a lobby journalist to say these things and actually thought that Angela Rayner was doing this, that's even more concerning, you know, that this person has said that. And like I said, extremely delusional. But I think it's important, like you say, for us to also acknowledge the wider policies that this government is trying to pass too, as well as we can condemn these things, and it's right that we should talk about these things, but let's not lose sight of the harm, the mass amount of harm that this government is causing to women, to working class people, mm-hmm. to vulnerable people, to minorities. Yeah. And, you know, I know that we're not going to do it, but the media in general should not be allowing them to get off with it, particularly in the context of the cost of living crisis.
It'll be interesting to see if this MP is ever identified. I suspect they will not be. Okay, our final topic this week. Will you vote till you balk? The Scottish local elections are this Thursday, the 5th of May. They're conducted under the single transferable vote system. This means, unlike first past the post, where you put an X in the box, you put a number to indicate where you rank the candidates. So the debate is as to whether you should rank all the candidates or just the ones you like. Brian, you had a lot to say in this issue.
We had a lot to say about it when we were originally going to chat about it on Monday, wasn't it? Vote to your bulk, and then people are like, no, you only vote for certain candidates, people that you like, and all these kind of things. The STV system is designed so it's a single transferable vote, and you basically rate every candidate that's on the paper in order of your preference, right? But there is no rule that says that you have to vote for all or all candidates or any more than one, right? So basically, you do whatever you like, right? But if you want to follow the STV system, which, by the way, I think we're really lucky to have, obviously we can really question the size of the wards and how many people represent it and all those types of things. Like, we can definitely have that discussion, and it may be a good discussion to have after the election. But for me personally, is I do rank all candidates. And I'm quite strategic the way I do it, particularly when you get near the bottom. I always make sure that I make sure the Conservative is the last one that I vote, because out of the really horrendous options that we have, they're the most likely to be elected. And, you know, so, for example, in 2017, in the ward that I lived in, we had like a UKIP candidate and then some other weird candidate, you know, on the right. It wasn't the Family Party, but it was, you know, of that ilk. And I actually put them before the Conservative. So it's almost like for me, it's about my single transferable vote is about supporting the party that I like most. The other parties that, you know, I'm happy to, you know, or would rather see elected than others. And then, you know, as soon as it gets to number five or six, it's like Operation Block Tory. And that's just the way that I vote. So was I booking? Probably earlier than what I should have been, but of course, for me personally, I vote to I book and beyond, apparently.
the way I've always understood STV elections is to vote till you broke. I wanted to bring this subject up because everybody I've asked has given me a different answer. So I wanted to hear what you thought. What I'd understood about STV, and I hope one of you can clarify it for me. If you don't vote and you have no preferences against a candidate, when it comes down to a round and they haven't reached the threshold, they might get your vote, or is it there no way for you to? Mm-hmm. How does that work? Because I've seen a couple of different people explain it a couple of different ways. So I just wanted to try and clarify that. Because like you, Brian, I would put the Tories dead last because they're the biggest party with the highest chance of getting elected. So you rank them like your lowest number that you've got.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I would do it. That's the way I've always done it.
Highest number, no lowest number.
Highest.
Don't vote Tory.
Don't vote Tory, no.
Yeah, no, with the, you know, if you don't, so say you just put preference number one, right? So say you're going to vote for, say you've got five candidates, and, you know, you've got a Green Party, and then you've got, you know, your number one choice is the Green Party. Number two is, you know, you would go to SNP, right? So say you've got number one and they get eliminated in the first round, your vote goes into the swathes of people who basically did not transfer, okay? Right. But if you voted for Green 1 and SNP 2, number 2, and then Labour number 3, for example, and your vote would be transferred towards the SNP in the second round, it wouldn't just basically be deleted. It wouldn't just disappear. And it's not that your vote would go to electing somebody else, but it wouldn't go towards you electing your second choice. That's basically the best way to try and describe it. And I know there's loads of ways that people look at these things. And, you know, some of the most amazing videos are about people trying to explain the Holyrood regional system. It's amazing with the music and all these different graphs and stuff. And it's the problem is the voting system, if you read the information from the Electoral Commission, that's the best advice because what they're doing is they're not sort of convolutedly saying, well, you know, we want to elect this particular party, but we know that it's going to be difficult for them because they're not going to get loads of first choices. So try and do this. You're not trying to beat the system. That's how the system works. It's up to you how you wish to use your vote. And I would encourage people to not only just vote for the party that they want to see, you know, the number one choice, but almost saying, well, you know, my number one choice is unlikely to be elected in my ward because it's the first time the party stood, or they've got quite a small gathering, but I really want to my number one vote to be this particular candidate. But in the event that they're not carried through into the second or third round, this is the other parties that I would be happy to almost endorse or to vote for. And then, of course, when we get to kind of round four and five, it's basically now I'm just trying to stop the Tories from getting in. That's, you know, that's just my perspective anyway. And I'm sure there'll be loads of tweets with folk going, nah, you can't do that because that's more likely to get this person in for that reason. Well, I don't agree.
If I'm down to a situation where I've voted, you know, I've ranked, you know, my Green Party first, you know, through the SNP, through Labour, through Lib Dems, and then you're right into the dregs, the nasties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does it really hurt the Tories to put them last any more than not voting for them? Because surely if I rank them behind UKIP, it only really hurts the Tories if they're up against UKIP for the last seat. And I'm not really sure that UKIP getting elected would be any better than the Tories getting elected. In fact, I could see situations where a Tory candidate would be unpalatable but not quite horrific. Whereas a lot of these other parties, you know, like a Scottish Family Party, I couldn't imagine any of their candidates not being monsters. Whereas I've met Tories who, you know, they're business people and that's why I think they're Tories. And I think sometimes they're just not that bright, I think, and they think they need to be Tories because they're into business and things like that. But on the whole, are actually half decent people, just not really that clued in politics, to be honest. I don't think I could ever find a likeable UKIP person, for example.
So would you not want to rank the Tory? Would you not be
normally
worried?
I would rank as many of them that I can really genuinely say I prefer them over them. Mm-hmm. Like,
the selective ranking?
Yeah, but I would do it up to a book, basically, not beyond.
You'd just retch.
Yeah, where Brian's projectile vomiting everywhere to get to the end of this list. Like, I would rather have a Lib, if I was going to be represented by a Lib Dem ahead of a Tory, I would take that. I would really? I mean, definitely the Tories are worse than the Lib Dems. Surely, do we not agree in that?
Well, yeah, most of them. But no, I totally see where you're coming from. But for me, it's like when you get to those rounds 5 and 6 that where I'm just trying to basically withhold that vote from the Tories. But I understand what you're saying, that if you get to round 4 or 5 and you've just decided not to carry the vote forward, there is a risk to me that more people going into that did not transfer would potentially boost the Conservatives to win that seat. That's the only thing that I can think would be the case. And for me, when it gets to the wretch stage, I'm just trying to withhold that vote from the Conservative candidate. That's just the logic that I always carry forward.
But what I mean is, would the, if my vote went into the did not transfer pile, is that better than it going into the, you know?
But the answer is it depends. And this is the thing. So it depends on the dynamics of the rounds that everything's gone through. So it could
and
be
each
that,
ward and how many candidates there are.
I mean, chances are the UKIP one would already be eliminated.
Exactly.
So I don't think we're going to solve this problem.
The answer is there's not a definitive answer to this. This is the thing, and this is why, you know, the Electoral Commission will say this is how you vote, and they say, you know, they give you the flexibility because it's for the individual to decide this is how I want to use my vote. For me, the most important thing is that the Tory is not elected, so I want to withhold my vote from ever transferring to the Tory, and that to me seems the most logical way to prevent the Conservative being elected, because these other mad fringe parties will never be elected.
Yeah, see, I'm lucky I've not got any mad fringe parties in my ward. I've just got your standard.
Your Holyrood constituency standard.
Yeah, and your SNP, Green, Labour, Lib Dem, Tory and an independent. So, you go.
What's independent like, though? They're always a...
Yeah, always a hoot.
A mixed bag.
I thought she was a yoga teacher for the village up the road, and I was like, oh, she sounds all right, but apparently no, she's a different person. So I need to, there's not much information. She's not done much campaigning. I've not got a leaflet from her, so I don't actually know who she is.
Sorry, I was just confirming who's standing in my ward. So it's me for the Greens.
You're the Green candidate.
Yay!
2 SNP, 2 Labour and a Tory and a Lib Dem. See, we kind of hope there would be at least one kind of crazy fringe candidate just to make sure I beat somebody. But
oh, my love.
Oh, David.
I'll just settle for beating the Lib Dems then.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know. Mine's is a really small list, I think. I think we're a three-member ward, and we're the really strange mix of an SNP, a Tory, and Labour. Yeah, because where I live, at the other end of the ward is the really posh part. And at this end of the ward, not so much. So it's one of those really diverse, quite strange wards, I think. It's quite a big one because a lot of the area is not necessarily highly populated. And it just seems like there's just again, similar to you, like the sort of Holyrood constituency standard candidates to choose from. But I can't really find much about my Labour candidate. However, their leaflet has come through the door today for the first time. It's the first time I've heard anything from Labour at all. I've had like 3 or 4 Tories leaflets posted out, one dropped off.
Fancy.
And well, money more like. Mm-hmm. And then I've had one SNP one, which I believe was hand delivered. So
yeah, we've had a lot of Lib Dem material as expected in Mogai. We get a lot of it in the Domino's pizza leaflet.
It's just so interesting.
We do. The Tory stuff gets delivered with the community magazine because you can pay the 15-year-olds to do your campaigning. All our SNP stuff is hand-delivered or handed out at stalls. But we had some Green stuff, which was nice. I'm pretty sure I saw some Green folk out stomping the streets.
Nice.
Our Lib Dem candidate is the current Tory leader's wife, which is interesting.
Oh yeah, you mentioned that before.
Yeah.
Literally.
A local election drama.
Coalition.
Was it the Holyrood election or Westminster? But certainly one of the elections here, the Lib Dem candidate was a Tory councillor like 3 months before the election.
Yeah, they're interchangeable, aren't they? It's weird. It's just weird. It's a weird setup here. We had a Labour, a Lib Dem SNP Tory elected in our ward last time. I think, oh my God, my brain's went melted. I can't
That happened in a few places around about sort of rather when Cambers Lang ended up with a 1-2-3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a weird mix, isn't it?
Traditionally, they were a lot more sort of like SNP Labour, and the Tories just pushed their way in with that kind of good result they had with sort of the Labour vote dipping.
The council here was always heavy Lib Dem, but that vote's just vanished.
Collapsed.
So, yeah, collapsed.
And this is
I'm hoping we get a Green councillor in Eastern Bartonshire. That'd be nice.
It would be good. It would be good to see Greens, more Greens in different councils, particularly more rural councils, particularly more in sort of councils out with cities, you know, city centres, basically, because that seems to be where a lot of the Green vote is in Edinburgh and Glasgow and, you know, and these sorts of areas. It would be good to see some in the northeast. It would be good to see some in Aberdeen, you know, and places like that.
South Lanarkshire.
In Blantyre.
In Blantyre specifically.
I know.
Are you excited, David, about the election?
Oh, yeah.
Riveted.
Absolutely riveted about it. But the thing is, if you know anyone that lives in Blantyre, give them a text right now and get them to vote for David McClement of Scottish Green Party.
Well, thanks for joining us, guys. Thank you, everybody that's listening. You can find all our previous podcasts at leftungag.org, as well as written articles. We have a monthly North American-based podcast called World Beat with George Collins. And we also have the Talking Sense podcast with Kat and Erin. Check them out. And if there's anything you want us to talk about on Holyrood Ungagged, you can tweet us at _ungagged, hashtag Holyrood Ungagged, or send us an email at ungaggedleft@gmail.com, putting Holyrood Ungagged in the subject line. And if you enjoyed this, please give us a 5-star review on whatever podcast platform you use. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.